You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Southern Foodways Alliance work wouldn't be possible without generous donors. Today we thank Maker's Mark, a family-owned distillery in Loretto, Kentucky, that still rotates barrels by hand and dips each bottle of bourbon in their signature red wax. It's the perfect bourbon for sipping on your porch in the cool of the evening. We're also grateful to longtime friends Lodge Cast Iron, a family-owned foundry in South Pittsburgh, Tennessee. From Camp Dutch ovens to cast iron skillets and grill pans, Lodge makes the cookware that you need for your socially distanced dinner parties and camping vacations.
I'm John T. Edge.
And I'm Melissa Hall. We're your hosts for Gravy.
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 A production of the Southern Foodways Alliance, Gravy tells new and complicated stories about the changing American South.
Amanda Little is a journalist who writes about the environment and about innovation. She's a professor of investigative journalism and science writing at Vanderbilt University. And she has shown a particular fondness for far-flung and sometimes hard-to-stomach reporting that's taken her to ultra-deep oil rigs, down manholes, into sewage plants, and inside monsoon clouds.
Amanda is the author of The Fate of Food, What We'll Eat in a Bigger, Hotter, Smarter World. That book, her latest, explores how we'll feed humanity sustainably and equitably in the climate change era.
She traveled to 18 states and 13 countries and into top secret labs and apple groves too, researching this book. Melissa talked with Amanda about the urgent need to reconcile traditional agriculture with innovative technology so that we can feed ourselves without destroying the planet and each other.
Welcome to Gravy, Amanda Little. It is September 2020 as we're talking, and in addition to the global pandemic that we're all living through, in just the last 3 weeks, we've seen, or a few weeks, maybe not three, we've seen a derecho in Iowa, twin hurricanes in Louisiana and Texas, fires in California, and that's just here in the U.S. So all of this combines to make my planned first question for you seem both necessary and absurd. And that's to say, could you talk about how climate change is affecting the global food supply?
Yes, I can. And I'm so happy to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me. I love your work. I love your organization. And I am really delighted to be here. This is such an important time for this conversation. And it's a sobering time. I think we all have our minds on the pandemic. And of course, the pressures of the pandemic on our food system have been very apparent. We've seen disruptions in meat processing facilities. We've seen the exposure of the really unethical conditions for workers in processing facilities. We've seen significant rollbacks of protections for workers, environmental protections, food safety protections, which I've been writing about in Bloomberg, where I contribute op-eds. And that has been really important in some ways, because it's exposing a lot of existing problems in the food system that will be exacerbated by climate change, already have been, but will be even more difficult to deal with in the years and decades ahead because of this, because it's the pressures of climate change on food producers are more chronic and more complicated than the pandemic pressures, right? In some ways, we're getting a little kind of sneak preview right. of just how antiquated our food supply chains are, and that we haven't designed our food systems to be able to adapt to and certainly not preempt major disruptions. We have, of course, very centralized food production that is vulnerable to disruption. So we're talking a lot right now about the importance of distributed food production, which I know many sustainable food advocates have been talking about for years and decades. But we've been talking about resilience, the importance of food, of resilience in the food system. And the pandemic has accelerated those conversations and really exposed, again, how antiquated and sort of unprepared we are to deal with food system disruptions. Climate change going forward is going to make that even more difficult, right? So it's more likely that farmers and food producers in certain regions might face disruption that might be related to a storm or a withering drought, we might see disruptions from invasive insects or bacterial blight, withering heat and fires, right? Just this summer, and in actually recent summers, consecutive summers, California has faced withering heat and fire damage to avocado and citrus and almond and strawberry farms, to livestock production. Water-intensive agriculture has been taking a real hit from heat and drought and certainly fires. The Midwest has been dealing with kind of the opposite problem of too much water, right? Storms and rainstorms last summer drenched fields so that they were too wet to farm. And this summer, of course, windstorms and have wiped out soy and corn crops. So it's really taken a toll. But what's so confusing about the impacts of climate change on agriculture is that they take so many different forms. And so it's, in one region it's drought, in another region it's superstorms. In another, it's a fungus or bacterial blight. It's in some regions, it's weather volatility. It's very subtle shifts in season. It's an early bloom in an apple orchard and then a normal freeze that takes the whole thing out. So I think the thread of connection between all these stories is that climate change is something we can taste, right? This is a kitchen table issue in the literal sense. This surprised me as a journalist, right? Because I had been writing about climate Right. change and climate impacts on and its relevance in the energy industry and in transportation sector and so on. I hadn't really been thinking about climate change in food terms. But I began to realize that, as one scientist put it to me, the single biggest threat of climate change is the collapse of food systems.
And I, the other sort of, is as we think about climate change and the different ways in which climate change manifests, I'm reminded in your book, you quote, I think, a professor from Columbia who says something to the effect of agricultural tools, like from the beginning, are about coaxing more food from the land with less human effort.
Yeah, that is a quote from Ruth DeFries in The Great Ratchet. And I highly recommend that book to anyone who's interested in the topic of agricultural history. She's an amazing mind. She said every new agricultural tool introduced since the first farming settlements, has been designed with the same goal, to coax more food from the earth with less human effort. And I think this is important context as we consider how we'll feed a hotter, more populous world in the coming decades, right? We've spent the better part of 10,000 mm-hmm. years developing a succession of tools to create more food more easily, more abundantly. All of them have been, starting with the plow, right? And every tool since then, right, including synthetic fertilizers, have been temporary solutions that generation after generation get replaced or upgraded to work on larger scales. And I found that important because we live in a moment right now where we have a very polarized conversation around food. You have this huge amount of enthusiasm, especially in Silicon Valley and major investors like Bill Gates, who have said food is ripe for reinvention. And now it's time to, throw technology at the problems of vulnerable food systems. And then you have a lot of sustainable food advocates who are really concerned about this because there have been so many failures in the past in this effort to apply technology fixes to food production, right? It's diminished the food quality and flavor and safety. We've had a lot of failures in terms of high-tech food. and there's been an argument for de-inventing food. Actually, let's go back to pre-industrial, pre-green revolution agriculture, right? Let's restore tradition in food production. And so there's been these kind of two camps, the reinventors and the de-inventors. I find myself just kind of returning to kind of high carbon food habits of, picking up whatever I can at the grocery store that's been shipped long distances and, going back to the barbecue. And I really struggle with this. I mean, I was wondering, how are we going to fix the problems in our food system if we can't necessarily rely on a critical mass of backyard farming vegetarians to, fix it from the ground up, right? And I've been to slaughterhouses. I've seen the worst of our food system in my reporting, and still I'm committing many of the crimes of an unvirtuous eater. Picking up long distance products and eating meats and things that I've really, really struggled with that. So I kind of thought, how do we do this on a grand scale? How do we make sustainable changes and build resilience and sustainability on a grand scale in a way that's affordable and accessible to all of us? And it's a twofold challenge. One is, how do we fix the existing problems in our food system, the problems wrought by the Green Revolution and in industrial agriculture? And how do we also begin to prepare for these increasing pressures of climate change and disruption in food production? So those two questions really drove me into my reporting.
Yes, and I think that as a person who would consider herself both a good reader and a good eater, I think that one of the challenges is, and it's actually refreshing to hear this challenge a little bit as you describe your reporting of this story, is that it seems as though the answer is not simple math, which is what we want it to be, 2 + 2 = 4, but actually a fairly complex algorithm of two sides who are distrustful of one another, mm-hmm. Two sides who don't really even seem to speak the same language, finding a middle ground. And those two sides are traditional agriculture and emerging technology.
Yes, beautifully said. Yeah, it's true that there has to be a synthesis of the traditional and the radically new. That's difficult because we're so emotional about food, right? I am someone who was raised in a household where food was a proxy for love. My mom communicated her love and affection for her children through the food she cooked. She was not verbally very affirming, but she was very generous with butter and cream and sauces and gravies and all the things served with them.
Right.
So we're very emotional about food. And it's very hard to think, all right, well, let's compromise. Let's sort of do this one way or the other. I mean, it's sort of like saying, I want to be sort of half in love with someone, right? Like you either fully do something and live something or you reject that way of life. I mean, that's the way we relate to this topic. So it's very hard to say, yeah, we have to do a little technology and a little, you know, tradition and make it sort of ancient and new at the same time. That's deeply disturbing even, and certainly just uncomfortable for a lot of us on this issue, right? Because we want to be so absolute about the way we want to do it, right? This is how our family eats, and this is how our community eats, and you know, and it's a very absolute position. I think though that we leave so many eaters behind when we think in terms that are so absolute. It's a combination of technology and kind of state of the art science around food and food production. And it's also borrowing from the wisdom of the ages and borrowing from the principles of sustainable agroecology.
I think that's probably why I found the weeding robots to be, I don't know, charming's not the word, but I found myself, very interested. And also the weeding robot, because, you know, that's a technology that acknowledges, like, you know, you can't just spray everything down with DDT, right?
Yeah.
You've got to, like, you know, weeds have to be dealt with by somebody and in some way. So,
I'm glad you raised that, because for me, that was the kind of linchpin moment in my research. And I'll give the listeners a little context. So there's a Peruvian-born entrepreneur and engineer named Jorge Herrod, who lives in Silicon Valley now. And his company, Blue River Technology, invented this weeding robot named CNSpray. And I went to see the maiden voyage of CNSpray in Arkansas, and was kind of expecting like C-3PO to walk into the field in glittering gold with like pincers and to pluck weeds. That's what I imagined the future of robotic weeder to be. And actually it was a tractor with a bunch of cameras on the back of it under a shroud. And the cameras are able to distinguish between weeds and crops. And they can send little spurts of concentrated fertilizer or herbicide onto the baby weeds. So you have a tractor that's going like kind of at tractor speed, which is 12 miles an hour going down the field, and it's going pss, 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 pss. And it's shooting these tiny little jets of fertilizer. Concentrated fertilizer, which can incinerate baby weeds. And it's eliminating the weeds and sparing the crop. So no chemical actually hits the crop. And that as an alternative to broadcast spraying, which is the way that herbicides are typically delivered,
right,
can eliminate about 90% of chemical applications in fields. And I watched this robot learning as it went, like in the way that a toddler does. It was learning and getting more and more precise as it moved down and more efficient in its deployment of this, fertilizer. And at first it was just using dyed water to see how specific it could get. But you could see it hitting pigweed that was surrounding a baby rice crop or corn crop. And it was sparing the crop in the middle and hitting just the weed itself. I mean, it was getting so specific as to how, and some of the little spurts of chemical were as small as a thumbnail, right? And so, because it was so targeted, as opposed to just blanketing field with chemicals, right? What's more exciting than eliminating 90% roughly of herbicide use, is that this bodes very well for a future of intelligent machines that can treat plants individually rather than on a field by field basis, on a plant by plant basis. So you have, this allows for the, you know, the application not just of herbicides, but also insecticides and fungicides and fertilizers, where the machines can read the crops, understand what they need, and give them only exactly what they need. And eventually, this kind of sets the stage for more diversity in fields and intercropping. And, you know, the longer view is that larger farms can begin to mimic natural systems when you can bring crop diversity into the fields. And we know that diversity is essential to building resilient food systems. We've just had stupid machines, basically, that have been able to only treat one crop all the same way, down rows and rows of the same crop. And so that to me was, and Jorge put it to me this way, he said, robots don't have to remove us from nature. They can help us restore it. Another turning point was when I was in Kenya and talking to some scientists there, and they said, you know, you have this very kind of absolutist idea of either, you know, heirloom indigenous crops or industrial agriculture. And it has to be both. We have to be able to cultivate our heirloom and indigenous crops, but we have to do so in a way that they can resist and adapt to new pressures. So it's not, do we have heirloom crops or do we have GMO crops? It's, do we have ways of breeding heirloom nutritious crops that can withstand new climate pressures?
And I think that bit of amazement comes through in the book. And, you know, I will say, as understanding you as a person who's sort of seen the worst parts of the food system and the realest parts and the bloodiest parts of the food system, this book is ultimately hopeful. And I wasn't expecting that. And does that hopefulness come from that sense of amazement or somewhere else?
Well, thank you. That's the highest compliment. And I really did feel hopeful after it. I felt hopeful for two reasons. One, because I met so many scientists and farmers and engineers and activists along the way across, you know, many countries and states, and actually met many of the most hopeful thinkers and food growers that I met were outside the U.S. And really thinking in a dynamic, exciting way. For example, you know, even folks thinking in ways that don't seem directly related to food, but are essential to our food future and our food security. For example, engineers in Israel working on a drought-proof water supply, finding ways to recycle gray water and even sewage water. To be hyper pure and reusable, and to, you know, be able to cycle through, you know, and develop a sustainable reusable water supply, and also remove salinity from ocean water. And we've heard about desalination plants that are popping up all over California. But there were so many different realms of you know, innovative thinking that I encountered, using AI, artificial intelligence and robotics in aquaculture to make aquaculture sustainable, to significantly reduce the environmental burdens of fish farming, and in meat. I mean, we've seen so much progress in plant-based meats. I even explored cell-based and lab-grown meats, which initially really upset me. I'll just be honest. I was like, and I did. I ate a plate of lab-grown duck breast that had been harvested fresh from a bioreactor and had to kind of sign my life away before I did so. But the more I learned about that, even some indoor cropping and some vertical farming, there were some approaches that were that were really actually not nearly as kind of threatening to my understanding of sustainable food and functioning natural systems as I imagine them to be. A lot of it was a lot of my concerns about these areas of innovation were based on just a lack of information and a lack of understanding. And now there were plenty of areas of technology applied to food that I looked at that were not appropriate solutions, and that, you know, we're not technology saves the day and helps us build resilience. There were, you know, we have to be very careful and cautious about some of the emerging, you know, smart ag or climate smart agriculture solutions on the horizon. But we need to inform ourselves. And there's a lot of really exciting progress out there that I think serves the and serves and supports the principles of sustainable, low carbon, resilient, and local agriculture. So I was pleasantly surprised by all of it. And in the last chapter, I explored even the kind of whiz bang out there sci-fi stuff, the food replacement, the Soylent and the 3D printed food pellets at the U.S. Army Research Lab. And even there, I found some unexpected optimism and some unexpected hope. So it surprised me, too, to really see that there can be a powerful synthesis between our values you know, people who hold dear traditional foods and sustainable farming methods, and who also want to see that made available and affordable to everyone, and who want to see us persist in the decades of hostile climate pressures to come. I think that there's very good reason to be hopeful.
Thank you so much, Amanda.
Matt Pearl produced this episode.
We thank Wendell Patrick for Gravy's theme music and Jazar for our donor music.
Managing editor for Gravy and all other SFA media is Sarah Camp Milam. Mary Beth Lassiter serves as our publisher.
Visit southernfoodways.org to learn more about who we are and what we do. While you're there, please consider making a donation to the SFA or becoming a member if you're not already a member. Your dollars help us make Gravy. They fund our work, and we need them. We want them. We thank you for those dollars.
I'm Melissa Hall.
And I'm John T. Edge. Thanks for letting us pour some gravy in your ear.